this is my weekly podcast, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, a show dedicated to sharing stories and spreading awareness about maternal mood disorders. For show notes and more information, please go to my website, ppdadventures.com. There's also a Facebook page, facebook.com/ppdadventures. And now, on to the show. Hello, adventurers. This is episode 44. I'm recording this on it's Thursday morning, technically. It's, 14 minutes to noon. So we're going to call it Thursday morning. And I meant to get you this episode days ago, but we had an unexpected trip to Nebraska happen. Nathan's grandfather got sick, so we wanted to go visit. And we had a great time. It was bad circumstances to go, but the best visit possible. We had a great visit with his grandpa and his grandma, the kids' great-grandparents, and it was the first time they met them. And then we went to the farm where Nathan's dad and family works, and we had visits with aunts and uncles and cousins, and it was a really, really good visit. The motivation for it, not so great, but the visit itself was wonderful. And something I keep going back to and learning and just embracing more and more is that for me, life is about people and love and connections. So the fact that I wasn't going to have a chance to do this episode on time really didn't bother me. Sorry if you've been annoyed and your commute has been missing an episode or your dirty dishes or whatever you do when you listen to this. But for me, I was okay with it. It was like, well, we're getting to spend time with family, and we're lucky that we're able to get out there and have the kids meet their great-grandpa before he passes. And so it was a good visit. I don't want to get too emotional about it right now, because I just want to give you this episode. It is Shannon this week, who is, like me, a recovering lawyer, and she had infertility issues before she was able to get pregnant, and then had postpartum depression, anxiety, and OCD. So we had a lot of the same experiences, and yet our stories were also very, very different. So I am going to turn you over to the very capable hands of Shannon, and I will see you on the other side. Hi, Shannon. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I know a bit about your story and how you suffered from infertility and pregnancy losses before you had your daughter, but why don't you tell our listeners out there, wherever it makes sense for you to begin?
Okay, well, as we discussed previously, I am, like you, a recovering attorney, and I now am a stay-at-home mom to my 5-year-old daughter. But before all of that, my journey, I guess, probably started when I was my husband and I were diagnosed with, infertility with no really known cause, which I think happens quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went down the trail of IVF to become pregnant. Unfortunately, I did become pregnant a couple of times, but technically the IVF treatment failed. I had about 4 early miscarriages in the first trimester, which I think probably contributed to my mental health problems after I did give birth. I also had to have a DNC at about 10 weeks, and if anyone's ever had one of those, they are not fun. And it was a very stressful time period in both mine and my husband's life to attempt to get pregnant and also deal with the multiple and recurring miscarriages. But finally, after some prodding by me, my infertility doctor, I requested that they kind of do some testing to try to figure out why I kept having miscarriages. And they did do some testing, and I was borderline positive for something called antiphospholipid syndrome, APS, which can cause blood clots in the placenta, which leads to miscarriage. So the thinking was, the next time, if and when I got pregnant, that I would take a daily blood thinner shot in my belly while I was pregnant. It was called heparin, and it's a blood thinner so that there would not be blood clots in the placenta, and therefore I could, you know, carry the baby to term. So we did our last IVF treatment, and that failed, and we decided to start looking into adoption. And funnily enough, I became naturally pregnant, and I started as a blood thinner. And, you know, I sailed through the first trimester, luckily, and we were very happy, and it looked like, you know, this pregnancy was going to go to term. And it did, in fact, go to term, and I had my daughter, who's now 5 months old. But during the pregnancy, it was, you know, pretty stressful because we had had 4 previous miscarriages. You know, we were sometimes waiting for the other shoe to drop, you know, is something going to go wrong? You know, are we really going to make it to the finish line? And I had to do, you know, I was technically a high-risk pregnancy. I was 38, and also I had, you know, this APS and was on the blood thinner, which is you go into labor while you're on the blood thinner, you could hemorrhage. So I had to be induced at 38 weeks so that would not happen. And I actually was fairly lucky. I've heard, you know, nightmare stories about being induced. My labor was only 9 hours, which is not bad, I think, for an induction. But the stressful part was during the labor, my daughter's heart rate kept going down. It would go down, and it would come back up, and it would go down and come back up. And they thought maybe she had the cord wrapped around her neck, but turns out she did not, and they still don't know why her, you know, she was stressed during labor. But so I had to, you know, that was a bit stressful for me and my husband to worry about her. Given our previous losses, you know, we knew that anything could happen. So, you know, they kept having to, I don't know, I had like 3 different heart monitors by the time I was, you know, pushing to get her out. I had, you know, 1 on the outside and I had 2 on the inside. And I know 1 was actually on her head, I think, or something like that. So I finally get to pushing her out. And again, I only pushed for about an hour, but her heart rate kept decreasing during that time. My OB pretty much yelled at me, you know, because her heart rate was going down and did not come back up at this point, and pretty much yelled at me, "You have to get her out in the next 2 pushes." And all I could think was during that time, if I do not get her out, she is going to have some kind of brain damage from the lack of oxygen or something. I don't even know if that was true, but that's what I thought at the time.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, he's like, "You need to get her out in the next 2 pushes." So, you know, I pushed as hard as I could, obviously, and he used the suction and got her out. She wasn't crying or anything, which kind of concerned me, and they whisked her away for the NICU team to look at her. And I remember them saying that her first Aspar score was a 1, which I know you're not supposed to think about the first Aspar score, but, you know, a 1 is pretty low, and I was very concerned about her. And luckily, they said the second app, I think they resuscitated her, and then the second APGAR score was 9. And so she was healthy, thank God. But that was kind of a stressful labor for me, you know, kind of worrying about her and wondering what was going to go wrong, if anything. And luckily, she was, you know, a happy, healthy baby. But it was a bit of a stressful labor. And I felt like, it was very anticlimactic after her birth. I almost felt nothing. And I wonder if something in my brain, like during her labor, to kind of protect myself, because I had so many losses in the past that I just could not deal with, you know, all the stress that was going on during her labor. I mean, I can't really say for sure, but I just felt numb after she was born. And I didn't feel like an immediate attack into her. Obviously, I wanted her to be healthy, and I loved her, but I didn't feel like this overwhelming, I don't, maybe it was unrealistic of me, but I thought that I would feel this overwhelming, you know, love for her, and I would just be so happy, and I would be crying, and, you know, and my husband was also very, you know, it was very anti-Semitic for him as well, so I wonder if we weren't just kind of in, what am I trying to say, survival mode, in a sense. So I kind of felt like something fixed in my brain at that point, and that was really the beginning of my journey into my maternal mental health issues. So they eventually gave her to me, and they, you know, I started breastfeeding, and they said breastfeeding was going great. And so we lived about 5 minutes from the hospital, so I told my husband, you know, you might as well go home and get some rest, which in hindsight was probably a mistake not to, you know, have me there with my thoughts all alone in the middle of the night. It's probably not a good idea, but at the time I was thinking, you know, at least one of us should go get some rest, you know, he should go home and get some rest. But apparently, and I don't even remember this because it was kind of a blur, but my husband said I called him the next morning at about 4 a.m. and I said, you know, something's wrong, you need to come here, you need to come to the hospital right away. But I meant something was wrong with me, not the baby.
Oh.
Something's wrong with me. Yeah, not the baby, thank God. But she stayed happy and healthy ever since, so now that was. But, you know, I said, something's wrong with me, you know, you need to come. I couldn't really explain to him what was wrong with me. I just remember I was, like, crying in the bed, and I really couldn't stop crying. And there was an OB who was doing, you know, the rounds. It was not my regular OB. It was the OB on staff at the hospital. And she came to check on me, and I was crying in my bed. And so she, you know, asked me if I had a history of depression or if I had antidepressants. And I was put on, you know, very, I think the lowest dose of Prozac, which you can go on, this is like 20 milligrams. I was put, I did have like a very minor, now I know it's minor compared to my major depressive episode, but it was kind of a minor depression after my first year of law school, which probably should have been a hint that maybe this wasn't the right career choice for me, but nevertheless, I pursued it 12 years later. I finally decided, okay, yeah, this isn't the right career choice.
We could have another podcast for lawyer law school survivors.
We definitely have to. So, you know, you got to pay off the student loans and all of that fun stuff, and then you just kind of get knee deep into it, that you really don't know what else you would be doing, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So then, so she said to me, but she had only talked to me for about 5 minutes, but she said to me, I think you might have postpartum depression, and I'm going to give you a prescription for 20 milligrams of Prozac, which you've been on before, and, you know, I think you should fill it and take it. And I was just so almost, like, dumbfounded. I didn't, you know, in the end, she was right, but I thought, you know, I thought to myself, how can she know that I have postpartum depression, you know, just talking to me for 5 minutes? Like, she knows nothing about my history other than that. So I was hesitant, and I did not fill the prescription. Or take it. And also I didn't really, because I was so like kind of in a daze and shocked that she said that, I didn't ask her about breastfeeding. I didn't know if it was safe for breastfeeding. I just really didn't have a chance to ask her any questions. And I was also, you know, exhausted from everything. That first night in the hospital, let me go back, I kind of skipped this part, before I called my husband. I did not sleep at all because I was deathly afraid that my daughter was going to die of SIDS, or that she, you know, I had to constantly check on her to make sure that she was breathing. And this sounds ridiculous, and it was ridiculous, but I thought for some reason that the nurses did not know how to swaddle her correctly. You know, they swaddled like thousands of babies, and I've never swaddled one. I was afraid that they did not know how to swaddle her correctly. And, you know, I felt like the blanket was too close to her mouth and her nose. So every time, you know, they would swaddle her, I would have to check her and, you know, push the blanket down to make sure, you know, I thought she could breathe and was not going to die. So I did not get very much sleep that night, which, you know, in addition to having to, you know, breastfeed her every 2 hours is not, you know, ideal.
So she was she was out of the NICU by then?
So I thought, better once I get home and I get rest, and, you know, she can't really diagnose me after 5 minutes, and, you know, all of that fun stuff. And I continued to breastfeed my daughter. Several lactation consultants came by and said, you know, you're doing great. One even said, you know, you're the best, you're doing the best on the floor of all the moms that day. And I did have to stay one extra night at the hospital because she had, my daughter had been checked out by the NICU, so they required, normally I would be discharged after the first night, but I had to stay an extra night. And so that night, the intrusive thoughts began. I did not know they were all intrusive thoughts. I'm calling them intrusive thoughts now because I know that's what they are. But I started having visions of my daughter being thrown against the wall. And I wasn't throwing her against the wall at this point. It was just visions of her, like, someone. My visions didn't really specify who the person was. It was just seeing her being thrown against the wall. And again, I just thought, okay, this is sleep deprivation. I'm tired. I need to get some rest and go home. And, you know, I'll feel much better. And my husband thought the same thing. You know, I'm just tired. Let's get home and, you know, get into a routine and you'll feel much better. So, you know, we're eventually discharged from the hospital and we get home. And it just seemed like my daughter was breastfeeding constantly. Like, she was constantly hungry. Like, I never got a break. Like, I put her down for maybe 20 minutes and she'd want to eat again. And, you know, I'd taken the breastfeeding classes and read all the books. And, you know, I was adamant that I was going to exclusively breastfeed my daughter. So I thought maybe this was just cluster feeding. Now I know they probably wouldn't cluster feed that, you know, 3 days old, but I'm thinking, okay, maybe she's just cluster feeding. So again, I'm not getting any sleep, and my intrusive thoughts continued to worsen, and I didn't know why I was having them. I thought, you know, okay, again, I'm just sleep deprived, but then, you know, my brain started wandering into places like, why am I having these thoughts? Does it mean I want to harm my daughter? Why am I seeing visions of my daughter being harmed? Does that mean I want to harm her? Oh, that must mean I want to harm her, you know? And I started having visions of myself harming my daughter, which were very, very, as any mom knows, has had harm intrusive thoughts. They usually go to the person or thing that you love the most. And OCD can be very insidious that way. And it basically attacks the people that you love the most, and you have the most, you know, it's like a horror film in your brain about the person that you love the most. It's just very anxiety producing. And, you know, I thought maybe I'm going crazy, maybe I'm having postpartum psychosis, because I had never even heard of intrusive thoughts. I now know that, you know, 90% of moms have reported having intrusive thoughts about their child, but, you know, nobody talks about it. I'd never read about it in a book. I just basically never heard about it. So I thought I was going crazy, essentially. I thought I was, you know, maybe on the verge of postpartum psychosis. Again, now I know that I was not on the verge of postpartum psychosis because I the thoughts were causing me great stress and anxiety, so much so that I could not eat anything. I couldn't stomach to eat anything. I could not sleep. I would try to sleep, you know, even when my mom or my husband was watching the baby, and I literally just could not sleep. So, whereas when you have postpartum psychosis, you obviously think, you know, because you're in the middle of psychosis, you think harming the baby would be a good thing. For example, send the baby to, you know, heaven or to be with God or whatever. You're also trying to do the best thing for your baby, but you're in the middle of psychosis, so your brain's not, you know, thinking quite clearly. So I was not eating and I was not sleeping, which are not good things. And I didn't want to tell my husband or my mom or anyone about the intrusive thoughts because, you know, I was very ashamed of them and I was afraid of what they would think of me if I told them about the thoughts. And so this continued on for a few more days. You know, we go to my daughter's, on top of all of this, we go to my daughter's, you know, I think they do a 3-day checkup after they're newborn.
Mm-hmm.
And they had told me that she had lost too much weight. So she had to be supplemented with formula. And I just, you know, broke down crying. I felt like a complete failure for not being able to breastfeed my child. I did not want to give her formula, which, you know, at the time I had, you know, bought into kind of all the fear-mongering you know, things about formula that you hear about formula. You know, your baby's going to be obese, and, you know, she's going to be down a couple IQ points, and it's going to affect her gut chemistry and all these, you know, all these things that you hear about formula. But I knew that I had to supplement her with formula because she had dropped so much weight. But I wanted to talk to a lactation consultant as well, just to make sure I was doing everything I could do to produce breast milk for her. So, I mean, I think the not eating did not help with not producing breast milk. I mean, I knew I had to eat something, and I would try to eat stuff, but I just literally couldn't. I mean, I've never felt like that in my entire life. I literally just could not eat anything. And I lost my baby weight in, like, 2 weeks because I just was not eating anything. So, which is not, you know, normal. Going back to the lactation consultant, I had met with a lactation consultant, and she said that I was breastfeeding fine, that my milk probably had not come in yet. You know, sometimes it takes five days for your milk to come in, and that what I could do is hold my daughter for 10 minutes at each breast. By this point, she had stopped lactating because she wasn't getting anything, and she was just screaming when she was at each breast. And I guess I'm kind of going out of order here. Let me rephrase that. They told me to hold her at each breast for 10 minutes, you know, to make sure that she's understanding, like, this is where you get your food from. Then bottle feed her the formula. That, you know, takes about 40 minutes because you have to burp them and everything. And then she told me to pump for another 40 minutes. To make sure, you know, my milk was coming in.
Oh, my gosh.
And I remember just looking at her saying, and I'm supposed to do this every 2 hours, so when do I sleep? Because that literally gives me a window of, like, 20 minutes. So when am I supposed to sleep, right? And I just got a blank stare from her. And I just remember thinking, how is this something that is being recommended to a new mom? I don't get it, right? So I just broke down in the parking lot, and I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but me, being the type A personality that I am, aka, you know, lawyer, law school, I did what I was told. I was told that that's what I had to do for my baby, and so that is what I did. And in hindsight, again, that was not probably the best idea, given that I also was having trouble sleeping. And I remember the first time we gave her the bottle, I mean, she just sucked it down like she had been starving. And thereafter, that's when she started to refuse the breast. She was like, I'm not getting anything from your breast. I'm not going to, you know, so she was hungry and screaming at my breast, and I'm supposed to hold her there for 20 minutes.
And that's screaming. And that's supposed to create a positive connotation.
Trying to get her to laugh. And then you just feel like even more of a failure, right? Because your baby doesn't even want your breast. So, I mean, my intrusive thoughts just worsened. I just was crying all the time and depressed. I had just major anxiety where I felt like I was literally buzzing. I know some people are like, I don't really understand that, but I literally felt like I was buzzing. I couldn't watch TV. I was so anxious. I couldn't focus on anything. I also was not getting anything when I was pumping. I was maybe getting a few ounces out of one breast and nothing out of the other. So finally, my husband was just like, and, you know, I'm not the kind of woman where, you know, my husband just decides things for me. But at this point, I think we both knew that my mental health was not all there. And he just was like, that's enough of this. We're not going to try to breastfeed anymore. We're going to, you know, just 100% formula feed. And it was kind of like a huge relief to me for someone else to make that decision for me. Because I needed permission from someone to say, you've done enough, you've tried hard enough to breastfeed her. And I just was not getting that. I met with a lactation consultant 2 other times after that, and I just was not getting that from, you know, people I perceived to know what they were talking about in terms of breastfeeding. And I just was not getting that from them, and I needed someone to say, it's okay, you've tried hard enough, you've done enough, you know, we're just going to formula feed her because that's what's best for her and you. And our family. So we made that decision, but you know, my mental health continued to spiral downward, and I started having thoughts like my baby would be better off without me, my entire family. harm intrusive thoughts, which I had not told anyone about. And I thought, I need to take care of these thoughts. I honestly thought I might harm my child. I started, because we started formula feeding, I didn't need to be there all the time. So I started avoiding her because I was afraid I was going to harm her. And I finally decided that the only way, because I could not stop the thoughts, and the only way that I was going to be able to, keep myself from harming her was to basically, commit suicide. And so I started having suicidal thoughts. In the meantime, I also was, we were in contact with my OB, and he had prescribed me some Ambien. And even on Ambien, I could only sleep like 2 or 3 hours a night, even on the Ambien. That's how high my anxiety was. And something deep inside of me said, your daughter needs a mom. Your daughter needs a mom. You need to tell someone. So I did. I told my husband and I told my mom about my suicidal thoughts. And obviously they thought I should go to the emergency room. And I agreed to go to the emergency room. But I also told them about my intrusive thoughts, and they did scare my husband a bit. They didn't really scare my mom, but they scared my husband. And, he wanted me to tell the doctors about it at the emergency room. And I was adamant that I was not going to tell them, and that the only way I would go to the emergency room is if he promised not to tell them either, because I was just convinced that they would take my daughter away from me. Mm-hmm. And that is not what I wanted. So, and my mom also used to be a social worker, and she kind of convinced my husband that, yeah, maybe that wasn't the best thing to do, is to tell these ER docs, these thoughts that I was having. So now I've heard horror stories of people saying they did have PPOCD. They went to the ER and, they were improperly diagnosed as having postpartum psychosis, and, their CPS was called and their children were taken away from them, or they weren't allowed to see their children where they were in the hospital. So I'm actually fairly glad that I did not do that at the time. And I didn't want to be, I somehow still have the wherewithal to say I didn't want to be in like just a generalized emergency room, mental health unit. I just felt like, I don't know why I had this inkling, because no one had ever told me this, and I maybe read like maybe 4 sentences of a paragraph about postpartum depression in one of my pregnancy books, so I did not have a lot of knowledge about it. But I thought, probably better for me to be at a specialized unit that treats only postpartum depression, because at that point I had some, I was like, okay, I probably have postpartum depression. I never heard of postpartum anxiety or postpartum OCD at this point, but I was, pretty self-aware that I had postpartum depression at the very least. If not postpartum psychosis, because I was convinced that maybe I was going to become psychotic. So at the very least, I wanted help with that. And so I did a Google search, and I actually found the perinatal inpatient unit at University of North Carolina, and we live in Northern Virginia, so it was only about a 4-hour drive, and my insurance did cover the hospital stay there, because somehow it looks like if it's in within a certain, 4 states of my state or something, it would cover it. So I was very, very fortunate, and they had a bed open, because at the time they only had 6 beds. I'm not sure how many beds they have now. Maybe they have some more, but they were full, and they just happened to have one of the beds open up. So so that bed was held for me, and the ER doctors let me go with the understanding that, which must have been so terribly scary for my husband, with the understanding that my husband would hide the knife and he would hide all the pills, and so that I would not be able to take any action that night. about that was I was so afraid I wasn't going to be able to see my baby, which sounds so, because I was avoiding her because I didn't want to harm her. But, you know, at the same time, I loved her and I knew that I needed to bond with her and I wanted to see her every day. And I didn't want to be hospitalized, you know, for a few weeks and not be able to see my baby. And at UNC, you can bring your baby and you see her at visiting hours. I just thought maybe, I don't know, maybe it wasn't the best environment and I'm in the Washington, D.C. area, and I was at a very large hospital. So you just don't know what it's going to be like in there. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I stayed in the general unit at my hospital, and I did not let Nathan bring Pippa there for the 4 days because there were some people struggling with some really scary shit, and my baby didn't need to be around that.
Right. That's exactly how I felt. And I also was scared for myself, to be honest. I mean, I'd never been in a mental health unit, and I was, you know, I was even scared to go into the PPD one. I mean, they still make you, you know, remove your shoelaces, and, you know, you can't have certain hair products and all of this stuff, which, you know, is very scary to realize that you're in that position.
It's terrifying.
Especially right after you have a child that you're supposed to be taking care of.
Yeah, and there's all this political correctness. Like, I felt like my psychiatrist was really politically correct about, because I was like, I'm having a tough time, like, knowing how to interact with the patients. And he's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, do you want me to just come out and say they're crazy? Like, why do I have to be politically correct? I'm mentally ill here. I'm struggling. Help me figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. I remember the ER doctor trying to convince my husband to admit me to the general mental health unit. And then my husband told me this after the fact. I was not, you know, I wasn't listening. But there was a man in a straitjacket, you know, and my husband was like, so will she be in the same mental health unit as him? I mean, God bless this man. I'm sure he was struggling, and I don't mean anything against him. But at the same time, there's a spectrum of disorders, and I'm not sure of mental health, you know, disorders, and I'm not sure if everyone should be placed and lumped all together, if that makes sense.
I agree completely.
Yeah, so the doctor said, and then my husband was like, no.
That's not
you know,
gonna,
it's... Because again, we're at a very large hospital, so a very large regional hospital, so, you know, there's going to be the whole gamut of different kinds of mental health problems, so... So yes, I was very fortunate that we were close to UNC and that my insurance would cover it. I later found out the insurance only covered the hospital stay, but not when I met with every doctor, which was like, or any therapist, you know, even if it was like an art therapist or whatever, all those were not covered. And you don't think to ask these questions, you know, I would think they tell you, but they don't. Insurance companies don't tell you. So of course they covered the hospital stay, but not the actual interaction with any kind of therapist or doctor, which was several times a day when you're in a mental health unit. Maybe like 5 or 6 times a day, and that's like $250 a pop. So that was not fun to get that bill, but I was very fortunate that they covered the actual stay in the hospital. And regardless, I would have done anything and paid any amount of money to, you know, to get the help that I needed. So that was a given. So we funnily enough, we had my daughter 2 weeks. So 2 weeks have passed since her birth. I know this all happened very fast. And like I said, I felt a change immediately after she was born. So I think that's where it clicked for me. But she had her 2 week appointment. So we were going to go to her 2 week pediatrician appointment, and then you know we had to make sure she was gaining weight and all that fun stuff. And then we were going to take off for UNC. And at that appointment, I talked to my pediatrician, and I told her that I had started to exclusively formula feed, and I was not breastfeeding anymore. And I got the whole speech about, you know, I have to tell you that breast is best, and, you know, I had to work 3 months to get my supply, you know, where it should be so that I could breastfeed my baby and blah, 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 blah. By this point, my pediatrician knows I have postpartum depression and that I'm going to UNC to be hospitalized. So I'm not sure if that speech was warranted at that time. I can understand when there are times when that speech is warranted. But breast is not best if you're in my situation, I feel, when I'm going to be hospitalized. And you know, the unit was very and is very supportive of women breastfeeding. And you can continue to pump, and they will provide you with, you know, medical-grade pumps. And, in fact, there was a mom there that pumped during that time. And that's totally fine, but, you know, I had to be put on medication that was not consistent with breastfeeding, and I honestly felt like, I don't know, it just felt like it was throwing salt into a wound. Like, I already had tremendous guilt about not being able to breastfeed her, which I feel like contributed to, you know, the decline in my mental health during that time. There was a number of factors that contributed to it, but I definitely feel like that was one of them. And I just felt like that speech was not appropriate because it just made me feel worse.
Oh, you can't see me, but I'm tearing up. Like, you're just, I'm so angry for you. And, like, my doctor made a comment, too, about breast is best. And it's just, oh, God, I just hate that the words rhyme and that there's nothing that rhymes with formula. That we can't come back with, like, oh, like, no, breast is not best. Just because it rhymes doesn't mean it's true.
And breast is not always best. And now that I've done, like, now that I've, you know, had some forethought and I've been able to think about it and read the research and all the stuff, it's not always that. And it's, you know, this could be a whole other podcast. You know, it's not always best. It's not always best for the family. And, you know, there are recent research studies that show that, you know, there isn't really that big of a difference between breastfed babies and formula-fed babies. But nevertheless, I would have liked to breastfeed, and I have no, you know, I'm not against breastfeeding in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying I feel like there's a lot of fear mongering that goes along with the breast is best message that isn't necessarily the best for women's mental health, or regardless, women that need to go back to work because they're only provided 12 weeks of leave, or, you know, I mean, not everybody, you know, works in an office where they can, you know, I mean, I know the law requires it, but, you know, has a beautiful, you know, like at my law firm, we had a very nice mothering room, and, you know, you could go there and pump, and you didn't have to pump in your office, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But not everybody works in those conditions. You know, some people have an hourly job at a restaurant or a retail store where it's just not compatible, but again, like I said, I will go off on that tangent. So we head off to UNC, and that's where I first, you know, I was informed that I did not have postpartum psychosis, as I had feared. Nevertheless, that fear lingered for many, many months after, even when I, you know, was discharged and came home, because it was part of my OCD. But I was, you know, then I was told about postpartum anxiety and postpartum OCD, and then I had, you know, all three of them, depression, you know, I had the triple threat?
Mm-hmm. I call it the trifecta.
The anxiety and the OCD.
The trifecta.
Yeah, and I probably had some PTSD mixed in there from, you know, the previous pregnancy losses. So, yeah. But it was a relief to find out that, you know, there was a name for the thoughts that I was having, and that it was a good thing that I was having anxiety about them and that they were causing me, you know, distress. But then you have to learn how to not have the thoughts cause you distress, but that was further on in my recovery to realize that. And I was put on, you know, I finally got a sleep medication. I remember the first night they gave me a sleep medication that finally worked for me, and I got 7 hours of sleep straight, and this felt amazing. And I was very, again, very fortunate. My mom and my husband came to UNC, stayed in a hotel. My mom took care of my daughter at night, and my husband took care of her during the day, and they brought me to her for 4 hours each day during visiting hours. You know, I would just do skin to skin with her and, you know, just talk to her and rock her and just, you know, basically be able to be with her, which is just, you know, a treasure. And I was there for about a week, and they also started me on some antidepressants, which seemed to be helping. And, you know, I felt like I was, you know, on the track to recovery, the start of recovery. It was a very long road with many ups and downs. I stayed in the hospital for about a week, and then I was discharged. And I went home and I found a therapist and I found an amazing psychiatrist who specializes in PMADs. And she thought maybe I wasn't on the right antidepressant or that was optimal, because OCD can be very difficult. And OCD was my main, I mean, I was depressed and I did have anxiety, but it was probably because of the issues of that. And so OCD was really my main issue. And looking back now, I realize I probably always had a little touch of OCD, probably, you know, a touch of diagnosable OCD, not like how people say, oh, I'm a neat freak, you know, I have OCD. No. I now know that I probably had intrusive thoughts my whole life. I would have episodes of intrusive thoughts for like 2 or 3 days, but I was able to get over them, and they would not, like, and they weren't harm thoughts. They were more like I would ruminate about something that happened at work, an interaction at work, or I do remember having some like intrusive thoughts as a child to like kind of like blasphemous intrusive thoughts, like I would be in church and I would think I hate God, you know, stuff like that. Which, you know, causes distress when you're 7 years old and you feel like you're not supposed to be having those thoughts in church. But, you know, I now realize those are intrusive thoughts. But where am I going with this? Okay, so it can be difficult to find. I just want to tell moms out there that it can be difficult sometimes to find the right antidepressants to work for you. And I had to try 3 different antidepressants until I finally found one that was optimal for me. It did not make all the symptoms go away. It did, however, make it possible for me to do the cognitive behavioral therapy I needed to do to overcome my OCD. And, you know, after about a year, you know, the anxiety kind of subsided and my depression subsided, but I still was having, you know, daily harm intrusive thoughts about my daughter. I was able to function, I was able to take care of her, but they still, you know, really bothered me, and I didn't want to live a life where I was having daily intrusive thoughts. And you would think, you know, I live in the Washington, D.C. metro area. You would think there would be plenty of treatment options for me here. And, you know, maybe I had a very deep, sneaky kind of OCD that was hard to treat. I'm not sure. But I did go through a few therapists, you know, trying to do cognitive behavioral therapy, or it's also called exposure and response therapy, you know, trying to, you know, overcome my OCD, and I just was not receiving really the treatment that was right on point. I even had one therapist tell me, you know, this is the best you're going to get, you know, you're just going to have daily harm thoughts about your daughter, and I refused to accept that. I had heard stories that you could overcome OCD and you do not have to live a life like this. And I just refused to accept that I would have to raise my daughter having daily harm thoughts about her. You know, I couldn't live that life. I could do it. I could do it for her. And, you know, I could do it for my family. And, you know, my daughter is happy and healthy. Luckily, she has no developmental issues or anything that resulted from my mental health issues, and she, you know, I mean, she, I don't think she realized when I was having intrusive thoughts, you know, they were more, it was all kind of in my head. But anyways, I refused to accept that, and I just continued to research and continue to, you know, read success stories and try to find, you know, the treatments that worked for me. So I did finally find a doctor in Bethesda, Maryland, which is about 45, not Bethesda, Silver Spring. I guess it doesn't really matter. It was about 45 minutes from my home. But I was willing to do it, and he is like a national expert on OCD, and he does not currently treat patients, but he has like, you know, 20 different therapists and psychologists in his practice that he consults with and that treat it. So, I mean, I finally found the right treatment for me. I found a psychologist that was able to really kind of get a hold on what my intrusive thoughts were. And, you know, sometimes I would get rid of one intrusive thought and then another one would pop up. So it was really a lot of work for me to overcome my OCD. And I think because because I've always had OCD, and then, you know, everything that happened, the previous miscarriages, the stressful pregnancy and birth, that all just added fuel to the fire. And, you know, not to mention, you know, however hormones affect your brain, but, you know, it just added fuel to the fire, and it just caused, you know, a huge fire, and my OCD just took charge. But I'm happy to say that I, you know, did all the work, and I'm recovered. And, you know, I just want to say, if you don't think you're getting the right kind of treatment, or someone tells you you can't get any better than you are, but you feel like you can, you know, I would urge you to just keep trying. And, you know, I think some people go to one therapist and they think, oh, you know, the therapists are kind of like a marriage, I feel like. You know, not every therapist works for everybody. You're not going to click with every therapist. And it's okay to say, you know, this is not working for me and I need to find someone else. I think that's okay. I think sometimes people look at therapists as like, even doctors, sometimes you don't click with your doctor and you need to find a new doctor, you know. But, you know, they're not all-knowing beings that, you know, they're human beings that make mistakes, or they just don't, you know, I think it's just, you just don't mesh with them well. So you need to find someone else that really can, you know, get to know you and that you feel comfortable talking to. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So I would stress that, because, I mean, I know some people, their toothpaste go away and, you know, on their own, and they have no problems thereafter, and that's fabulous. I mean, I hope that for everyone. But in the event that that doesn't happen, if you get the right treatment, you can overcome it. And, you know, the silver lining is I'm actually better now. My OCD is better treated now than it was before I had postpartum OCD. So that's a little bit of a silver lining. I don't know if I ever would have gotten the right treatment had it not taken over my life in a sense. You hear what I'm saying?
Yes, I am grateful I had postpartum depression, because exact same story. I had terrible anxiety, and I probably always had a little OCD, like with stupid things like counting steps. But,
right.
You know, it's nice to just not have any OCD anymore.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I have OCD that I didn't realize was OCD, or didn't want to accept with OCD. But I think another thing that just kind of boggled my mind after going through all this is that, you know, I now know that there are several risk factors to having a perinatal mood disorder, and I had several of them. Like, one is infertility treatments, one is previous miscarriage, previous history of depression and anxiety, a stressful pregnancy, lack of family support, because I don't have any of my family support. My family's in Minnesota, which, if you haven't already picked up on my accent, but which used to be much worse, you can believe it. I don't have my family here to support me. My husband doesn't have a lot of family here to support us. So, and I have, as I mentioned before, a very type A perfectionist personality about something, not about seeing my health, but about other things I do. So, you know, I feel like, had I been screened at some point, I'm not sure if I, you know, had I been screened, I would have been made more aware of, okay, you know, these are the risk factors, and I'm kind of at high risk for, you know, developing a perinatal mood disorder. Maybe this is something I should keep an eye out. Oh, and here are the symptoms. You may have intrusive thoughts about harming your child. You may not be able to sleep or eat. You may have trouble breastfeeding, or trouble breastfeeding is one of the also risk factors. I just feel like I can't believe that there's such a huge lack of screening and education, which I'm sure you obviously are aware of and have heard over time and time again, and it just falls through the cracks because the OBs don't want to take responsibility for it, they're not mental health providers, and the pediatricians don't want to take responsibility for it because, you know, they're treating the child and not the mother, but at the same time, the mother's health does affect the child. And I am happy to say that my pediatrician did actually screen me. At that point, it was too late. I was already on my way to UNC. But they did actually give me I can't remember what it's called, but that screening tool that they give her every, which is grossly non-inclusive of, you know, anxiety and OCD and things like that. But nevertheless, at least they did screen me. So I think education and of the risk factors and being screened is just so important and needs to be, somebody needs to take responsibility for it and do it for women. And also the whole breast is best mantra, I feel like needs to be, it can't be true 100% of the time. It's not a black and white issue. It's a very much a gray issue. And I think, it seems to me that people are starting to come around to that a little bit more. And I hope we just keep going in that direction where it's not necessarily the best decision for every family, regardless of mental health issues. I mean, there's all kinds of issues that interfere with breastfeeding, ability to breastfeed, time, you know, the luxury of time to do that. So, yeah, that's the end of my story.
You know, you actually, telling your story made me think of another issue about, this all happened to you in the first 2 weeks, and reading about just even info about postpartum depression or pregnancy books, they go on and on about how, well, the first 2 weeks, it might just be baby blues, but if it continues after, but your case was so severe that it was clearly not the baby blues, like within 24, 48 hours.
Oh, and, yeah. And really. I mean, I didn't know that at the time. Looking back, I clearly know it. I didn't know it at the time. I thought it was maybe just the baby blues and I was just not getting adequate rest. But, I mean, it just kept getting worse and worse by the hour, really, by the time I got home. And it was very clear to me and my husband. He knew something was wrong. Obviously, he did not know I was having intrusive thoughts and things of that nature. But he knew I couldn't sleep. He knew I wasn't eating. I mean, obviously, saw me crying all the time. You know, but it's a hard thing to accept. We just wanted to be happy. I mean, we finally got the baby that we always wanted. We just wanted to be a happy family at this point, you know, given all the trials and tribulations we had been through to have this child. You know, so I think it was a very hard thing for both my husband and I to accept. We just didn't want to see it at first. So it got to the point where it could not be ignored. But I think we, you know, obviously I did not, I mean, yes, it was very severe and it happened all within, you know, 2 weeks and I sought treatment, you know, relatively quickly. But yeah, I think for a while we were kind of in denial for a few days that, you know, oh, it's just sleep deprivation and you'll feel better and it is the baby blues. But, you know, once you start having suicidal thoughts, that's obviously not a normal thing and that's not the baby blues, very clearly. So, yeah, it was a hard road, but, you know, it is a hard road. I know some people recover quickly. I mean, everybody's recovery journey looks different. And I had a lot of ups and downs, and it was a hard road. But my mental health is better because of it. And, you know, it is something that can be overcome. And you can beat it, and you can defeat it. You just need to get the right help and the right treatment. And that's what's so important.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Shannon.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. This is a great thing you're doing. And, you know, one thing that really saved me, I was kind of insular during my recovery period because I was ashamed and I didn't want to tell anybody about it. But the one thing that really was a thread that I would hold on to on, you know, my darkest days and the days where I felt like I couldn't get up and I couldn't do it was success stories. So, you know, your podcast is really doing that for other women, and I think it's a great thing.
Oh, thank you so much. So that's it for this week. Next week, we have another interview, and then I'm going to be doing one more episode before taking a summer break of about 3 months, because I want to enjoy summer with my babies. This is the summer that Pippa is 4, and Julian is about a year and a half, and it never happens again. So I don't want to be worrying about getting the podcast done. I want to focus on my kids and having fun and building love and connections and getting my book done. because I am going to be working. I can't not work. I love my work too much. But the book needs my attention for the next 2 months to really get it done, because otherwise it's like I could finish it up for my editor in the next 2 months, or I could spend like the next 20 years working on it. And, you know, as between the two, the next 2 months just sounds a lot better. So I will miss you guys during the podcast break, but, and I'll think about you a lot. And if you want to email me, Courtney@ppdadventures.com. I love getting emails from you guys. But yeah, you still have two more episodes coming up. If you head over to ppdadventures.com, you can sign up for the mailing list, and that way you won't forget about us, and you'll know when the next episode after the summer break comes, as soon as it drops. I don't email very often. I promise I'm not going to fill your inbox with tons of spam. I'm never going to like give someone your email address. Oh my gosh, people could do that. There's a very special level of hell reserved for them. I won't be blasting you with daily or weekly or probably even monthly emails, because it's not that I'm lazy. It's that I have kids, and kids need a lot of work. My goodness, kids are a lot of work, and I love the work, and I'm just trying to immerse myself in it and enjoy it while I can, because I don't want to wake up one day and my kids are ornery teenagers who hate me and slam doors in my face, and I realize, oh shit, I missed their childhood because I was waiting for this, and by like waiting for something else, I missed the golden days of when they were young. And they're all golden days. I really believe that. They're all golden days. But I want to enjoy these golden days, and I don't want to miss them. So go sign up for the email list. You can do that on my website, or you can do that on, just shoot me an email and say, hey, Courtney, put me on your email list, and I'll get it done, man. That's how I am. I will get it done. Sorry, I sound out of breath. I'm doing multitasking. I'm working on my book, getting the podcast together, and exercising. So I don't have the, like, I was supposed to go to Zumba today. I was so excited for Zumba. And then my teacher, he got a real job. Can you believe that? The audacity. So there was a new Zumba teacher today, and she sucked. And life is too short to do a shitty Zumba class. So I left after 15 minutes, and I have my Fitbit on, and I have to get 10,000 steps today. And I have like a touch of a sniffle. So I am in between working on the book and doing the podcast. I'm sort of like, I'm running up and down the stairs at my parents' house just to like keep that heart pumping. So that is why I'm breathless. Also because I'm just so excited to be here, and I love you guys so much. If you don't want to sign up for the email list and you want to follow along, I'm on Instagram at Courtney.Novak. And there's also a Facebook page for this group, Adventures with Postpartum Depression. And I don't even know the address for the Facebook. So really, just go to the website and sign up for the email list. It's easiest on all of us. Okay, so that's it. And I will be back next week, hopefully early next week, with another interview. My goal is Monday, but you know how it goes. Postpartum depression is an incredibly lonely and isolating illness. Oh my gosh, as I work on my memoir, I just keep remembering. And it's so hard to make other people understand exactly what it is, because it is... If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, it is the drama of Mordor. I mean, you are Frodo, and you are bringing the one true ring, or whatever that thing is called, you know, and to throw it into the pits so that Sauron doesn't take over the world. That is what it feels like. That is what your hormones do to you. And yet, all you're doing is sitting on a chair breastfeeding, and everyone's like, what's the big deal? What's going on? So it is lonely and isolating. It is hard to make other people understand. And I'll tell you, I've been doing this podcast now for a year. I got an email from my... provider that it's been a year. So yay, happy birthday podcast. But I've been doing this for so long, writing about it, talking to people about it, sharing these stories, and it's still so hard to make people understand what it is. People who haven't been there, it is so hard for them to get it. And for those of you who are listening who haven't been there, thank you for trying to listen and trying to understand. But it is really tough to understand. And it's tough for me to understand when I'm not in the darkness. Like, I'm reading some of this stuff in my book in the first part, and I'm like, what was the big deal? And I'm like, oh, what was the big deal? Well, you were suicidal and you had insomnia and anxiety. Okay, so this ending was supposed to be like a minute long, and now I've been rambling for 5 minutes. So, lonely and isolating, I understand. You did nothing wrong. You did nothing wrong to bring this on yourself. This is not your fault at all. And with appropriate help from a doctor or a therapist or whoever works for you, you can and will make a full recovery. I love you, and I hope you have a great week.